It was a strange, weird barrier, this vast hedge of cactus and thorny acacia, of prickly palms and agaves that thrust out their spiked swords boldly from a buckler of spine-set thicket. What a barrier it was. A grey-green mighty wall of leaves all starred with pink and yellow and white cactus blooms over which birds, butterflies and dragonflies fluttered, while on the round fleshy leaves the cochineal insects gathered like tiny spots of blood, scarlet.
How did a 4,000-kilometre hedge, grown across India by the British East India Company, managed to disappear with barely a trace?
The hedge is this kind of very mysterious object and this very kind of mysterious history.
We only found textual evidence, but no photographs.
Why did the British grow this mammoth hedge? And why on earth a hedge in the first place?
It was like the one tax with which you could tax every individual. By restricting access to something that everybody needs, you cannot live without, and everybody is obliged to pay this tax.
It was a very easy way to make a lot of money for the British Empire.
I'm Himali.
And I'm David.
Poet and visual artist Himali Singh Soin and composer David Soin Tapizer collaborate as the duo Hylozoic Desires.
The term Hylozoic means the plant, the stone, the human all have an equal right to life.
They draw out uncanny connections between the natural world and human histories, often using one aspect of the environment as a prism through which to understand the world. In this case, salt.
We've been working on salt for the last 3 years. What if, just like snow lines or tree lines, salt lines were going to be markers of a new future, curbed and kicked by climate change?
Normally we don't think about salt, even though it's so life-sustaining, but it's actually one of these unseen forces that holds everything together, that makes life possible. And then we came across this crazy, crazy story, which was the salt monopoly during colonial times in India. And the hedge.
Before their installation here at Somerset House, Himali and David bring the story of the Great Salt Hedge of India to the courtyard. In this podcast, they trace the story of the hedge and ask what it can tell us about the relationship between history, storytelling, and the natural world.
The Great Salt Hedge was a 4,000-kilometer-long line that ran across the Indian subcontinent from roughly the Gulf of Bengal all the way up to the Indus River, now Pakistan. It would have stretched, say, from a London to Istanbul, maybe second or even greater than the Great Wall of China. It was established by the British East India Company in the 1840s to control the flow of salt across the subcontinent so that they could collect this immense salt tax.
And the big problem for them was that untaxed salt would come in from other territories. It would be smuggled in, and you could make enormous profits even with a small bit of smuggled salt. So they had to seal off their territory. And the hedge was their go-to method because it would have been too expensive to build a physical wall. So they grew a wall, essentially. They used, you could say, a very English method to build these barricades so people could not pass through there.
To give you an idea, by 1880, the income from just salt amounted to £7 million. That is in 1880.
One of the problems we were confronted with early on in our archival research was that there was no visual traces. There were merely descriptions.
And so as artists, then our job becomes, what if we speculate into these archives?
Perhaps the hedge itself as an archive, nature as archive, but nature also as a resistor to archive. In this podcast, we would like to find out what nature can teach us about archives.
And whose archives stay? Whose archives disappear? What if an artwork could actually create truth retrospectively.
Why was salt and this kind of salt tax so important? My understanding of this is essentially that it was a very easy way to make a lot of money for the British Empire, literally just a way to extract money from the local population and put it in their pockets. My name is Alexis Ryder, and I am a historian of science and the environment.
Alexis is a historian at Cambridge, and we have worked a lot together in the past, and she joined us on research on the salt hedge for this project.
The other thing that was so striking about the archival materials that I found around this was in the sort of 19th century, in really left-wing journals and newspapers, the kind of salt tax was written about frequently of all the kind of activities of the East India Company. This was often touted as like just the symbol of like, this is how kind of base and how money driven this project is.
One of the challenges for this project was finding this hedge in the archives.
The hedge is this kind of very mysterious object and this very kind of mysterious history. There were questions about whether names were metaphors or whether they were literal. So, for example, when you talk about the hedge, it was also sometimes called the inland customs line. So is a customs line something that's a physical object? Is it something that's been drawn on a map? Is it something that's just kind of conceptual?
We went back into the archives and found a lot of material from the Delhi archives to the state archives in Calcutta to the British Library. But we only found textual evidence, evidence of the guards and the gardeners, evidence of letters, of tables, and we found diagrams, but no photographs and no painting, nothing.
So why is the hedge so kind of thinly recorded in the materials, in the document materials? It's a complicated question, right? I think on the one hand, there is this question of how much hedge was there really? The other part of it can just be the kind of ways in which archives and materials like this are ordered and recorded, right? Someone in history at some point is deciding what materials are kept, what materials are discarded. And I do think that there is just this question of something organic that then inherently becomes harder to track and record and keep note of. And I think there's just something so powerful about something that is hard to find in the archives.
We always think of the archives we have as something so static that's kind of a reliable narrator, but it's not. Archive is never something static. It's always something we read through our present lens, and it's constantly shifting. I think for me, what's really interesting is the relationship between nature and archive. That's why it was such an interesting entry point.
What archives are is this kind of constant constitution of power. Who decides what to keep, how they decide to keep it, where they decide to keep it, all of that decision-making that is inherently like moves of power, and that just produces and kind of solidifies narratives. And so, yeah, I think that it's not neutral in any way.
Termites, as if you like, representatives of nature, are putting a limit in which how much can you archive, how much memory can you actually preserve for posterity. I'm Dr. Rohan Deb Roy. I am an associate professor at the University of Reading. I teach at the history department, and my work specifically looks at British colonialism in India in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And my current research project focuses around the question of insects, how insects and British colonialism interact with each other.
Rohan's research was very inspiring to us when we were thinking about this project and how the natural world can both resist and reinforce the methods of control used by colonial powers.
We know that the customs hedge at the height of its expanse was about 4,000 kilometers long, stretching all the way from the northwestern frontiers of British India to the coasts of Orissa, which is on the Bay of Bengal. But one of the recurrent organisms that kept interfering with what the British government wanted to achieve with the hedge were the termites. British officials often found that actually the termites were eating into various parts of the hedge, making it unviable as a stable infrastructural construction. So there was this constant kind of tension between the world of insects and the British imperial rule. The hedge is one of the most obvious examples. The other, of course, is the ways in which white ants preferred paper. And paper was at the heart of bureaucracy. But they're also the foundation for currency, for promissory notes. They're also the medium in which books are being kind of preserved. The entire memory of British Empire rests on the longevity and the durability of paper. And also timber. Timber, on the other hand, is the foundation of infrastructure, and that is fundamental for the sustenance of imperialism. So when we're thinking about vessels and ships, we're thinking about railways, we're thinking of bridges. So we're looking at a world in which the termites have a presence, because termites, they depend on these kinds of commodities and things to survive. So in a way, therefore, this tiny, almost invisible insect is actually attacking one of the greatest political powers that the world has ever seen.
I also love the idea that a kind of Western colonial perspective is one that measures and counts and names and numbers and classifies and observes. And how does the natural world then defy these methods of counting and telling histories in these organized logics? How does it create its own internal logics? In that, it becomes a kind of artist.
The British Empire was advertising itself, basically saying that we are providing a model of how a stable, enduring government looks like. We are basically providing stability to the subcontinent. Therefore, colonial infrastructures are here for good. Colonial paperwork is not going to disappear. But actually, that rhetoric of stability and permanence is questioned when termites are actually regularly on an everyday basis attacking paper and therefore questioning bureaucracy and infrastructure.
The piece that is installed in the courtyard at Somerset House for the exhibition is called Namak Halal, Namak Haram. And it's an 80-meter-long piece of textile, which is placed as if the map of the inland customs line was transposed onto the courtyard. It's organic cotton from India, and inspired by the fact that Somerset House itself was where the stamp office was housed, and most of these duties were taxed here. We imagined a piece that was block printed, blocks as this idea of stamping. So on one side, we have these very classified botanical prints, and on the other side, we have a swarm of termites. And they are stamped in as an emblem that replaces the lion, the symbol of empire, with a termite.
At one level, it is tempting, and I think quite justified, to look at termites as forces that actually tried to resist empire, right? White ants certainly put a limit, if you like, an ecological limit to the powers of the British Empire in a way that was tremendously effective. But at the same time, we also need to understand how political power is able to reappropriate the so-called resistors and the rebels as metaphors that suit their own political game. British imperial ideologues were extremely clever. So they would actually reappropriate the white ant or the termite metaphor as a label, as an adjective to define the colonized Indian subject in different ways. constantly suggesting that the termites are actually metaphors for the uncultured, the uncivilized, and therefore the political groups that need to be colonized by empire.
I think the weaponization of metaphor that Rohan mentions here is really quite interesting and important. One of the questions we were asking ourselves while going through the archives was, did this hedge actually exist? In the beginning, there were very few pieces of evidence that we came across, and we weren't quite sure. Then, as we found evidence in these mostly administrative reports, we asked ourselves, to what extent did the hedge exist? Was it kind of a symbol for something that the empire wanted to project? Was it really a complete line, or was it more small fragments that were blown up into a larger narrative?
I think there is this question of how much hedge was there really? Was it a kind of speculative fiction that the British Empire was telling itself? Was it something that they wanted to imagine and have people believe they had this huge kind of capacity and power to grow something like that across the whole of the country? You can look at like the efforts in the US to build a border wall, right? And these kinds of ideas, that concept of it is powerful, but then the actual doing of it is so impossible.
I'm going to read a quote here because I think it almost gave us the reason to create the artwork. It's by Henry Francis Pelham, an English historian. At its greatest, the inland customs line was 4,000 kilometers long and employed 12,911 guards and gardeners. It stretched in a singularly indirect line from the Indus to where the Madras and Bengal boundaries meet. It was presumably neither beautiful nor picturesque, and antiquaries had hardly begun to photograph when it was abolished in 1878. So this was interesting for us to come upon, that when British photographers were coming, they recorded the railway lines, they recorded their grand achievements in India. But perhaps the hedge was kind of a disaster in their minds. It was untamable and it didn't look very good, and they were having so many problems that perhaps it felt like a disgrace.
One of the first more complete accounts of this hedge that we came across during our research was a book called The Great Hedge of India by a writer called Roy Moxham, published in the early 2000s. And he had come across the story of a hedge, or the customs line rather, in a small footnote in an antique bookshop, and combined travel accounts with his research in the archives to write a popular science book. Sadly, Roy is not in the greatest of health at the moment, but a couple of days ago we heard through our producer that his brother John Moxham had in his possession some evidence of the hedge. So a couple of hours before the private view of the exhibition, we invited him into the studio to show us what he has.
In essence, the problem was salt. I've spent my life in medicine, and the fact is you can't live without salt. You've got a lot of salt in your body. All of us have got lots of sodium and chloride in our body. And you can't live without it. So if you find yourself in an environment where there's no salt, you're in big trouble.
During this exhibition, we sort of followed somewhat in the footsteps of your brother, doing our research, going to the archives, unearthing old administrative reports and maps. But despite all of that, the actual references to the hedge, rather than just the customs line, are actually quite fine few in between. So we were wondering whether through your brother there were any kind of physical evidences or proofs of that hedge that he had shared with you.
Sure. So he made several trips to India thinking about that, but didn't make a lot of progress. But eventually he did make some progress. So he made a trip in the late 90s to have another go at trying to find evidence that this hedge really did exist. He made three separate trips trying to find this evidence of this hedge. But he eventually, with the help of local people, managed to find the remains of this massive hedge, which covered hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles once, but there was a tiny bit of it still growing.
And we hear you have something to show
us. Well, when he went there the last time, he actually took just a little snippet of the hedge, of the same hedge. It's a thorny hedge. And he kept this twig in a little container in his flat. And I have it with me today, and I can show it to you if you'd like me to do so.
We'd love that. We'd love to see the twig.
So it's always been in this bottle. I've never taken it out of this bottle.
So what we're looking at is a bit of branch, perhaps 20 centimeters long, with some thorns coming out of it, possibly acacia. And alongside a small little piece of paper folded into two with some handwriting on it that says, "From remains of customs hedge at Paligar, November 1998. And it's both enclosed in a plastic bottle that could be sort of a version of a Coke bottle or a soft drink.
And you will see that it says November 1998. And it also gives the physical location of where it was found. And if you look in his book on this, there is a map. So it shows where it was in the hedge, okay?
And we're looking at the map right now, and it's basically where the customs hedge takes a turn from traveling in a southeasterly direction. So somewhere probably in the current state of Uttar Pradesh.
Yeah.
I must say that little piece of thorn is a very beautiful piece of thorn.
Yeah.
And this is amazing. I mean, you know, on one hand, it feels like I've grown up with just a thorny branch like this in my garden. But on the other hand, the way that it has been preserved, archived, if you will, the way that it just kind of sits in this plastic bottle with a little label feels like a genie in a bottle.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing is, and I think it's even mentioned in Roy Moxham's book, is that there's always a certain amount of speculation to what this is. That it's pretty certain that there was hedge where this was found. But is it the same plant that existed there, or is it an offspring? So we encountered this quite a lot during our chase of the hedge, in a way, driving along it. There's a lot of greenery, and a lot of it is where the hedge would have been. But is it the same, or is it different? So preserved like this in the bottle with a label and a cutoff that's now also almost 30 year old makes it sort of an archival document of something. So how does the natural world demonstrate the fragility of our present idea of archives?
Any geologist or earth scientist will tell you that nature is an archive, and that the earth is one giant archive, one giant machine for producing kind of archival records of deep time.
Beyond the termite and the hedge, we were interested in how other parts of the natural world can serve as a different sort of archive for time spans that go far beyond the human. Salt itself has a way of preserving and corroding our histories in interesting ways.
The salt mines in the UK during World War II, the Cheshire salt mines, were used as a space to kind of protect archival material from London. The thing that I find the most fascinating about salt and storage, which is efforts in New Mexico to use a huge underground salt flat deep in the earth as a place to store nuclear waste. It's this huge just shaft that goes down into a big salt flat where they are storing all of this kind of Cold War dross, so stuff that's radioactive and going to be radioactive for between 10 and 100,000 years. And they think that burying it in the salt is the safest, is incredibly safe, specifically because of what they call salt creep, which is the idea that if you bury something in salt, the salt will slowly continue to grow around it and really, really cement it in place in a way that is more protective than if you just kind of drill a hole in rock and store it in there. Our time span is always pretty short. And if you think about the kind of non-human history of salt and the way that a salt flat just produces and produces and produces, whether humans are around or not, kind of puts things in that really lovely perspective and scale. We also now have these really amazing kind of paleo archives that we are using to reconstruct the planet on these huge non-human timescales. So ice cores, I think, are the really obvious and kind of most charismatic example of that. But there are all of these other non-human archives, like tree rings, like corals, like ocean sediments, like tiny fossilized bodies.
I think another strand of research we've been sort of interested in is colonial legacies and how they reverberate in the present. And the hedge just seemed such a powerful example of the kind of unseen, slow violence of colonialism. We often think of these kind of massacres or singular events, but it's that sort of everyday violence, I think, that is not so present in people's minds. The hedge was a very powerful witness to that, and also that it had disappeared not only from the landscape, but also from public memory, was sort of indicative of our present moment of dealing with that colonial legacy.
The physical evidence of the hedge itself is almost disappeared. At one level, therefore, it talks about the fragility of imperial borders. The borders are drawn and they're permeable, they're fluid. So perhaps it's a reminder for not just scholars, but also for politicians, people who are interested in creating maps and drawing borderlands, that at one level, political borders are fragile and they won't last.
What was interesting to us was that it was not a wall, that this hedge ultimately was a permeable mesh and things got through. And in the way that Gandhi or Tagore might have said, you could control our materials and our bodies, but you cannot control our mind and our spirit. So, what got through? One of my favorite writers, Italo Calvino, says, fiction participates in the truth. And I think as artists, this is where we come in. You seek the gap in the archive. You see the injustice of what has been erased, and you enter right into it.
Thanks to Himali and David, Alexis Ryder, Rohan Debroy, and John Moxham. The process is produced by Alana Chance and presented by me, Laurent John, for Somerset House. The exec producer is Eleanor Scott. The Salt Cosmologies exhibition is up until the 27th of April at Somerset House. To hear more about the history of salt at Somerset House, head to our Sonic Histories page on the Bloomberg Connects app. There will be a new episode focusing on the history of the salt stairs coming in mid-April. See you next time.